Part 2 of 9 from set number 3014, The Great Magicians, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Eliphas Levy, Master of Magic.
The figure of Eliphas Levy, as well as of some of these other personages whom we have come to call Magi, require a little bit of contextual material for our understanding. First of all, the term Magi, which most people are familiar with primarily because of its application in the New Testament to the three wise men, also sometimes called three kings, who are said to visit the infant Jesus, is the term that has been applied of old to the priesthood of Persia, and therefore primarily the Zoroastrian priesthood, and maybe, I'm not so sure about that, by derivation later on the Mithraic priesthood as well. It is etymologically, in all likelihood, I mean the majority opinion feels it is derived from an old Indo-Aryan word or root word M-A-G, mag, which has to do primarily with greatness. And we find the presence of that word incorporated in some of our English words as well, such as, let's say, magnitude, magnification, and in all likelihood, believe it or not, even the word magnet, because the name magnet being derived from the Greek island of Magnes, where apparently there were a lot of lodestones to be found, or probably meteoric pieces of metal which had qualities of magnetic attraction. Well, that doesn't tell us, however, a great deal about what we really want to know. And what we really want to know is, of course, in this particular case, applied to the figure we are discussing this evening and some of the others thereafter, that, let's say, there has always existed throughout history, as far as we are able to discern, a tradition of spirituality which for the most part acted as an alternative to the popular folk religiosity or folk spirituality of any particular people or any particular time. Professor Robert Elwood, an old friend, formerly of the University of Southern California, I think has pretty much coined the term for this of the alternative spiritual tradition. Because it always stands there as an alternative to the most popular form of religiosity of the day. Now, in some cultures, this inner or alternative or minority spirituality stood in a kind of complementary relationship to popular religiosity. And it supplied what popular religiosity did not supply, and this was understood, and both the, the popular cultus of the day or of the age of a particular culture and the inner or alternative spirituality helped each other out, supplied each other what the other one did not possess. This is fairly certain that the situation was such, let's say, in Greece, in Egypt, Persia, certainly, and those are probably the main great cultures of which we know. And these had their particular mystery traditions, as the Greeks called them. Now, unfortunately, this kind of happy cooperative arrangement did not exist or obtain in some cultures. And certainly the culture that came to be called the Western culture, the Mediterranean culture largely founded upon Christianity, or we might say on Judaism and Christianity, inasmuch as Christianity was a Jewish heresy, carrying a great many of the ideas and teachings with it from Judaism. This culture, from a certain time on, did not look with favor upon the alternative spirituality. And the result of that was that the alternative spirituality went underground. Now, I am pretty much telling you what all of you have heard or read before, but somehow that's not stopping me at this time, so I'll continue with it, but not for very long, you know. And so now comes what really should interest us regarding our particular subject, that the alternative spirituality was always there in Western culture, in the shadows. And then from time to time it managed to step out of the shadows and show itself, and usually attract a certain amount of attention. And then pretty much because of the repressive forces of the mainstream culture and the mainstream religiosity, it stepped back into the shadows again. Now, one thing that may be confusing to some who study this subject is that practically every time this tradition stepped out of the shadows temporarily, it showed itself in a different way in many respects. So that we have different names, different mythologies attached to the tradition, yet when we are able to look at it in depth, both analytically in an intellectual sense and more importantly looking at it with the eye of the spirit, we discover that it is the same, only in a different garment. Almost as if a kind of principle of spiritual reincarnation went on, not with an individual or a group of individuals in this case, but with an entire spiritual tradition. And so I'm certainly not going to go through all the embodiments, let us say, of what also has been called the esoteric, meaning the internal as against the exoteric tradition. But we might say that certainly there were great manifestations of that tradition, which when viewed on the surface seem rather different from each other, but which in their interior content and in their content and intent can be seen to say the least very closely related. Now then, when it came to a period of time which Carl Gustav Jung, who certainly was more than a little bit of an esotericist himself, called the true Dark Ages, namely the 19th century. Now, I think now in retrospect we could add the 20th to it as well. And I'm sure that Carl Jung would agree, you know. And when it comes to that period, we find that around the middle part of the 19th century, the ever-present esoteric tradition emerges curiously and interestingly enough under the umbrella term of magic. That, let's say, that way of denominating, namely giving a name to, a nomen to the tradition, is not exclusive as it doesn't last terribly long, but that is how it comes to the surface. So that we have, of course, the great big shake-up at the very beginning of the 19th century, that is in the 1800s, called the French Revolution, which of course is a great big social political upheaval and which also is at least in part combined with the tail end, so to say, of the era of the Enlightenment, which unfortunately for the culture came to manifest to a very large extent by the time of the 19th century in rationalism. And this rationalism was, let's say, ended up being a pretty bad thing. Rationalism is a sort of a spiritual weed killer, because it kills just like a chemical of that sort. You know, if you pour it on your flowers, spread it on your flowers as well as your weeds, it'll kill everything. I certainly have experimented with such weed killers, and they, if you use enough of them, they will turn California into a replica of the Sonora Desert, you know. So that, let's say, rationalism did wound the mainstream religiosity of Roman Catholicism and also to some extent Protestantism quite severely. But it also wounded the esoteric tradition quite severely. And so by the middle part sort of the 19th century, the need arose for it to step out of the shadows once more in a manner which would attract interest and approval of a certain elite, of a certain growing edge of the culture. And that is what happened very largely, initially, by way of the activities of one single individual, and that is the one whom we are speaking of tonight. He died in 1875, and he carried on his activities for a number of decades prior to that time. His influence was very great, not only on people who directly felt interested in and ultimately committed to the esoteric tradition, but on creative individuals of the culture in general. Innumerable French authors, and later on in quite a large number of authors of the German and of the English-speaking world, were greatly influenced by this person, such as, for instance, the French authors, and these were not really occultists, the ones whom I mention now. The occult group is yet another one, but people like Catulle Mendès, Villiers de l'Isle Adam, Joris Karl Huysmans, Baudelaire, Victor Hugo, Mallarmé, all of these were great admirers of and openly admitted many times that they were greatly influenced by the strange and mysterious man whom they called Eliphas Levi. And of course, by way of the Theosophical Society, which was founded in the very year of Levi's death, 1875, other things happened in that year too, such as the birth of Carl Gustav Jung, for instance, and on perhaps the less reputable side, also the birth of a man named Edward Alistair Crowley, and who, with his typical low self-esteem and self-deprecating tendency, upon his growing up, immediately proclaimed that he was the reincarnation of Eliphas Levi, having been born, I don't know, about 4 or 5 months after Levi's death. Now, what I propose to do at this point is to give you a picture, little highlights of the biography of Levi first, and then go into some of his teachings and try to explain in what way so many of his teachings were unique, and how they had really that great creative stimulating effect upon the culture and others. But I think it's quite important initially that we get a little bit of a picture of the man. And of course, actually his life, as far as the outer data are concerned, is fairly easily told. He was born on February 8, 1810, the son of a shoemaker in Paris. He was a solitary, artistic, meditative child. In 1822, at his first communion, he had a mystical experience relative to, as he called it, a God who sacrifices himself for his creatures. He was advised by his teachers, and he accepted the advice to study for the priesthood of the Catholic Church, which was, after all, the only one around. And so he entered first a kind of a little kids preparatory school, and then what often is called the little seminary, which is the lower, it's already a seminary, but of the lower grades. You usually enter that when you're about 10 years old, called Saint Nicolas du Chardonnay. And there he was influenced by a teacher, a priest, the Abbé Frère Colonna, who was eventually fired from his job, you guessed it, for heterodoxy and for heretical tendencies. So in the very training ground of the Roman Catholic Church, the little fellow, whose name incidentally by family was Alphonse Louis Constant, had received already some heretical indoctrination. He then entered the major seminary of Saint-Sulpice, and his life there was beset by difficulties. The large majority of his fellow students were sort of little career-crazy ecclesiastical politicians in the making, and all they were interested in was how to advance themselves in front of their teachers and how to sort of influence their future careers in a favorable manner at an early time. And little Alphonse found out that often, if you are looking for really religious people, the last place where you should look for them is in the seminaries and the training grounds of the churches. Unfortunate though that situation may be. And so he continued against considerable odds, and he already received ordination to the office of deacon, which is then and now the ecclesiastical office both in the Eastern and in the Western Church that is right underneath the priesthood. And he was assigned already to teach some religion classes in various schools, which he did. And there he, it would seem according to all indications, in a very innocent way, got himself into trouble. Because, I don't know whether this, it probably was at that time entirely, it was a girls' school where he was teaching, and wouldn't you know it, and you probably anticipated already, there was one particular girl there who liked the Abbé Constant quite a bit. But apparently not enough for the kind of thing that the French are noted for, but rather, you know, a very platonic relationship developed, and he was really a teacher and a kind of spiritual guide to her, but rather like the, I don't know, there is no longer any yellow press in the West because the entire press has turned dreadfully yellow, you know. So let's say, just like the journalists today, they immediately assumed that something very fishy was going on. And so the authorities took Constant, who protested very strongly, but they did not listened to his protestations, and they basically fired him. And so he left his ecclesiastical career and went for a while, however, to study at a monastery, which was the famous Abbey of Solesmes, which particularly music lovers or particularly admirers of Gregorian chant will know about, because the Benedictine Abbey of Solesmes, which still stands, has been the greatest place where Gregorian music was revived in modern times and still is. If you get a CD or whatever you get of Gregorian music, if it is by the monks of Solesmes, you're probably going to get a very, very, very beautiful piece. So that is where he went for a while, and in their rather extensive library, he became acquainted with various elements of the esoteric tradition as it existed in different periods, as well as, let's say, the life stories and the works of various Christian mystics, some of them perhaps of rather doubtful orthodoxy. I well remember many, many years ago when I studied a little bit of Gregorian and related music and things of that sort, not that any of it stuck, because I couldn't hold the tune then and I can't now, you know. But I looked at the literature that the monks of Solesmes, of course that was a later period, but they undoubtedly had these materials in their library before, published about the history of church music, and there was a volume there called Le Chant Magico-Gnostique, the Magical Gnostic Chants, wherein the author sort of analyzed how the barbarous words in the old Gnostic scriptures were probably chanted, and how this was related to magic in general, and actually to, let's say, ecclesiastical magic in particular. Now, you may imagine that in a monastery where such literature was around, the young Alphonse found probably a lot of stimulating and interesting literature. He thus developed a great idea, which occupied the first major portion of his life and which filled his inner enthusiasm, namely the idea of the coming reign of the Holy Spirit, which would replace the present age of God the Son, and also the role of the Madonna, the Virgin Mary, as the bridge between the two ages. Now, you need to keep in mind that this idea of the history of the world, at least up to a certain point, being divided into three great ages. The ages symbolically connected with the three persons of the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, was a not entirely heretical, but sort of a bit offbeat tradition in Christendom that appeared from time to time. It appeared particularly powerfully in the writings of a man who is usually called Gioacchino da Fiore or Gioacchino of Flora in the, I would think sort of 11th, 12th century, a Cistercian abbot, so it must have been maybe more 12th century, 1100s, in Calabria in Italy. See, I remember everything about him but the date. But I was never good at those sorts of dates. Let's put it that way. In any event, and Gioacchino Flora, who was a highly regarded man in his time, you know, popes sought his advice and all that sort of thing, he was a great advocate of this. And he said, and this is sort of how his philosophy regarding these matters is usually summarized, the age of the Father is past, the age of the Son is passing, the age of the Holy Spirit is coming or approaches. So Levi undoubtedly picked up some of this material and was inspired thereby, but he also apparently intuited another, I think, very beautiful and very interesting idea, which I don't believe is present, at least not in that fashion, in Joachim's writings, and that is that the figure of the Madonna, which is, after all, the only real archetypal representation of the feminine divine principle in official Christendom, well, Western Christendom, anyway, you have Sophia, the wisdom of God in Eastern Orthodox Christianity, that the figure of the Madonna would be the transition from the age of the Son to the Holy Spirit. And he may or may not have received the information intuitively, if not objectively, that, of course, in olden days, those strange people called the Gnostics, though the first and the most pernicious heresy, as they were called, had always associated the Holy Spirit with a certain kind of spiritual feminine keynote, and they referred to the Holy Spirit as she. So here you might say in a manner that he felt was appropriate for his time, had revived that teaching. It was under the inspiration of these ideas that he wrote his early works, which are virtually unknown today, certainly untranslated, which are L'Assomption de la Femme, published in 1841, The Assumption of Woman, La Bible de la Liberté, in the same year, The Bible of Liberty, Doctrine Religieuse et Sociale, in also the same year, Religious and Social Doctrines, and finally, La Mère de Dieu, 1844, The Mother of God. Now, of these, two are devoted to this kind of very mystical, very sublime, and very poetic feminism, you might say, namely L'Assomption de la Femme, The Assumption of Woman, and The Mother of God. Regarding the former, I may sort of throw in a slightly related information that, of course, at a much later period, just about 100 years later, in the 1940s, when Pope Pius XII declared the Assumption, that is, the going to heaven of the Blessed Virgin as a dogma of the Catholic Church, a person who I think was generally more, probably more familiar with Eliphas Levi than with Catholic theology, namely Carl Gustav Jung, rejoiced in a very powerful way and said and wrote openly that this was an archetypal development in the culture, and that now the elevation of the spiritual feminine had started, and whether the Catholic Church knows it or not, what it just started, a very powerful cultural development started now. It's kind of interesting that Levi was writing in a similar vein, just exactly 100, or not exactly, not to the year, but 100 years prior to that particular development. Unfortunately, I don't have really the time in this single lecture to quote a great deal, but his writings on these subjects are extremely poetic, filled with a tremendous amount of feeling, and indicating that it is particularly, you know, the keynote of love that is represented by the feminine, and that keynote, if it could really enter humanity and enter the culture, would be the greatest and the ultimate solution to the problems not only of religion, but of society as well. And a lot of his writings are, I read over some of the relevant quotations prior to presenting this, and a lot of them are sort of written in a poetic dialogue, as if two people were talking to each other. And there is the revolutionary you know, the radical, whom he probably sort of picked from the French Revolution, you know, and its aftermath. A radical who says that it's all got to go, you know. Society is rotten. All the institutions of society are rotten. Marriage is rotten. Well, I agree that many marriages are now as they were probably then, but maybe not all, you know, and so forth. And so that it all has to be swept away. And then there is the other dialoguing person, who is obviously Levy himself, who says, no, he says, we don't have to sweep everything away, but we have to reintroduce something that is not present. And what is that is love. He both implied and said that, you know, Christendom has been talking about love for, well, at that time for 1900 years, about, or 1800 years and some. And the reason that love is not really here and is active as it ought to be is because the feminine has not been given its due. That only when the loving quality of what now psychologically we would call the feminine psyche comes into activity and is into reintroduced into society, then it will take care of a great many of these problems, whether they are in marriages, whether they are in society, whether they are in government, everywhere. It says, without love, nothing works. Very, I think, very wonderful recognition, which is probably just as worth considering in these days as it was in his time, in his day. In his work, The L'Assomption de la Femme, he mentioned a number of other very interesting ideas, which I will just briefly review now. First of all, it is based on the translation of the Song of Songs of Solomon, the Canticle of Canticles, which, as you know, is a part of the Catholic Bible, but which, along with other items of the wisdom literature, had been eliminated by the Protestant reformers, and therefore you won't find it in the King James Bible. And Song of Songs has been an inspiration to quite a lot of people, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, the great mystic, having been one. And it's, you know, it deals with the ostensibly with the love affair of King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. But of course the mystics rather properly had interpreted this, well, let's say, as the love affair of the human soul with the divine in a feminine form. And interestingly enough, the wisdom figure in the Song of Songs is described at the very beginning of the scripture as black. And I firmly believe that the cult of the black Madonnas that flourished soon was inspired in a major fashion by the Song of Songs. In any event, Eliphas Levi addressed himself to it, and of course he also has material from other great mystics, St. John of the Cross, St. Teresa, and others. So in this work he made a strong case for the restoration of the feminine element to its due role in religion and society, as I just indicated before, meaning that if people would just be inspired by the kind of poetry that is in the Song of Songs, they would see of what a transformative and transfigurative role love can play, and if they would bring that, so to say, down to earth, then everything would be all right. Now, in the other book of this sort, La Mère de Dieu, the Mother of God, in a highly allegorical and visionary fashion, he reaches out also in part over the book of Revelation, then the woman crowned with the stars there, and so forth. And I'll mention something very practical and very regrettable along that line, if I don't forget it a little bit later, namely Eliphas Levi and the book of Revelation. Now, of course, unfortunately, at the same time, as I mentioned before, he also wrote two other books. And these had to do with society. They had to do with the social order. And they would probably be considered worthy of inclusion in the platform of many political parties today, but in his time they seemed very, very radical and very, very dangerous, particularly to those in power. And so what did they do? They took poor Constant, they threw him into jail. I am not even sure at this moment as to which government was in power, but, you know, it's the kind of thing that any of the governments around that time would have done, perhaps. The Bible of the Liberty, that was what they really didn't like. So he was condemned to initially 8 months in prison, but by some anything but benign intervention of the prison authorities, he spent 11 months there instead of the 8. Now, his personal relations with the feminine sex were, however, rather unhappy. This often happens. People who write very beautifully about women can't get along with them on earth. And you know what? I sympathize with them, but they also sympathize with the women who can't get along with the men. I mean, you know, it's a big problem. It's been there for a long time. And I really do not foresee any development soon which would change that fundamental problem. Nevertheless, he married Mademoiselle Noémie Cadio in 1846, who became a writer in her own right under the pseudonym Claude Vignon. After a few years of marriage, his wife left him and later divorced him legally as well. They had a daughter, Marie, who died quite early in 1854. Once before, it was apparently a sickly child, once before Eliphas Levi, by way of some Kabbalistic ritual, managed to heal her when she was near death, but ultimately she died in 1854. By the way, referring to his interaction with the women, it was also true that when he died in 75, as an old man, and, you know, except for a very few of his close disciples, Baron Spedalieri, who was a very devoted disciple of his, and a couple of others, there was practically no one there at the funeral except one old lady. And when they went up to her and talked to her, this old lady was the girl on account of whom he was expelled from seminary. She still held him in high regard, and when it's sort of a moving little incident. Then, beginning about 1849, which is, of course, in the immediate wake of the what was referred to as the springtime of nations, you know, all kinds of revolutions and things, uprising were all over Europe and so forth. Even in Hungary, one of my ancestors died in that civil war that we had between 1848-1849. Anyway, in 1849, Constant, as we may still call him, began his studies in what became his lifetime preoccupation, namely the Kabbalah. In 1856, he published his chef d'oeuvre, his chief work, Dogme et Rituel de la Haute Magie, Dogma and Ritual of the High Magic, which came to be translated into English generally under the title of Transcendental Magic. Actually, it was printed in installments once he wrote it between 1854-1856, then put into book form. This was followed later by two other books, The History of Magic and The Key to the Mysteries, and of these a little bit later. He had many interesting experiences of, let's say, a practical magical nature. Now, Eliphas Levi, as he came to be called later, and I'll mention to you soon as to how he picked that name, it's obviously Kabbalistic in Hebrew, he is generally regarded as a theoretician of magic, who was interested in the principles of magic rather than in, well, I don't know, casting spells and invoking spirits and things of that sort. But he did have some experiences along those lines. And one that he referred to in his writings occurred in England. And if I am lucky, I may even find some of his statements about that for you, because they are, you know, they are sort of exciting, as those things generally are. Kind of shows you that he was not only a theoretical magician. He starts out, in the spring of 1854, I had gone to London. So while he was in London, somebody approached him there. It was a lady, and she basically asked him whether he could perform for her benefit a practical work of magic, and what apparently she was particularly interested in, and what it came to be, was the evocation of an ancient spirit from the ancient world, of Apollonios of Tyana. This is what the lady said to him according to his diaries. "Sir," she said to me in French, but a heavy English accent, you know, the French are always, they always look out whether people who talk to them, whether they talk to them in French and whether their French is any good, and they generally say that it's not good, you know. In any way, says she, said with a heavy English accent, "I know that the law of secrecy is rigorous among adepts. A friend of Lord Bulwer-Lytton, who has seen you," Bulwer-Lytton, of course, was, you know, a writer along these lines at that time, who wrote the famous magico-mystical novel Zanoni, which you can still find sometimes. It's quite a good book. "So the friend of Lord Bulwer-Lytton, who has seen you, knows that you have been asked to produce phenomena and that you have refused to satisfy this curiosity. Perhaps you did not have things you required. I wish to put at your disposition a complete magical cabinet," whatever that is, "but I must ask you above all to observe the most inviolable secrecy. If you do not give me your word of honor on this matter, I will have you taken back to your rooms," because I won't talk to you anymore. What, probably her butler or somebody around would throw him back into his room. Huh? You know. In any event, he talked with her and he said, "Well, all right, you know, I'll do what you asked me to do." So after several meetings with his new friend, things were ready. And this is what he writes about them. "On the 24th of July, everything was ready. I would evoke the phantom of the divine Apollonios and question him on two secrets, one of interest to me, the other to the lady." So apparently she had a purpose. She wanted to ask the spirit something, which is good. "At first she had intended to witness the evocation in the company of a close friend, but at the last moment her friend became frightened and didn't come. Since the ternary or the unity is absolutely necessary for magical operations, I was left alone," because he felt there had to be either three or one, not two. Interesting. "The evocation was to take place in a small tower room. There I found four concave mirrors and a kind of altar, of which the white marble top was circled by a chain of magnetized iron. A pentagram had been engraved in the marble and gilded, and the same sign was painted in diverse colors on a new white lambskin hung beneath the altar." So anyway, "I was dressed in a white robe, quite similar to an alb worn by Catholic priests, but fuller and longer. On my head I wore a crown woven of vervain leaves and a golden chain. In one hand I held a new sword, and in the other the book of ritual. I started two fires with the necessary prepared substances, and I began first in a low voice and then progressively louder the invocations of the ritual. The smoke spread, and the flame cast a wavering light on objects nearby. Then it went out." Oh dear. He didn't see that. I said that. "The white smoke rose slowly over the marble altar. I felt as though the earth were quaking. My ears were buzzing and my heart pounding. I put a few more twigs on the fire, along with some perfume, perfume being incense. And when the flame rose, I distinctly saw in front of the altar a man's face, larger than normal, which dissolved and disappeared. I began the evocations again and stepped into a circle that I had previously drawn between the altar and the tripod. The mirror opposite me seemed to grow brighter little by little, and the pale form began to outline itself there, becoming larger and larger and seeming to draw nearer to me. Closing my eyes, I called Apollonius three times. When I opened them again, I saw a man before me, wholly covered by a kind of shroud, which seemed more gray than white. His face, which was thin, forlorn, and without any trace of a beard, did not exactly accord with the way I had first imagined Apollonius. I felt an extraordinary sensation of cold, and when I opened my mouth to address the phantom, I could not utter a sound. I then placed my hand on the sign of the pentagram and pointed my sword toward him, mentally ordering him not to frighten me and to obey me. The form became less clearly delineated and suddenly disappeared. I commanded it to return. I felt the air stir near me, something touched the hand that held the sword, and my arm was immediately numbed as far as the shoulder. Oh dear! I concluded that the sword had offended the spirit, and I placed it point downward in the circle beside me. The face at once reappeared, but my arms and legs felt so weak, and I began to feel so faint, that I took two steps in order to sit down. After I had done so, a kind of torpor overcame me, and I had vague sensations and visions, which I did not clearly remember afterwards. For several days my arm was numb and sore. The phantom had not spoken to me, but I seemed to hold in my mind the answer to the question that I had wished to ask, so that it was placed into his mind rather than otherwise. To the lady in question, an inner voice answered, "Death." It concerned the man about whom she wanted information. As for myself, I wanted to know whether forgiveness and reconciliation were possible for two persons about whom I was thinking. All right, well, that gives you a little indication as to, let's say, the practical magic that our friend was capable of. But let me just maybe give you one more little quotation from here, because I think it's so endearing. It's really about what manner of man was our friend Eliphas Levi. Here are some testimonies of some people who knew him. Alphonse Constant here wrote somebody, Mrs. Hutchinson, was the only man I have known who had attained true inner peace. His good humor was inalterable. His gaiety and liveliness knew no end. His brilliant Rabelaisian wit, profound for those who understand the hidden sense of his words, was equally pleasing to all. He was a man who loved to talk, but who avoided every indiscretion. He was both frank and quite reserved. And then here, in conclusion of this part, a little bit of what he wrote in a letter to his disciple Baron Spedalieri, and he wrote this only about a year before his death. "My old age is that of a Job or a King Lear, and I am perfectly resigned to it. My legs grow stiff, my teeth are falling out, and my eyes weaken. Drowsiness will follow me into the very street. My life is not much more than a struggle against death, and yet the good Lord knows that I am neither discouraged nor sad. The air is good and light still beautiful. I feel the real existence of good, and I am free of all that hinders thought. My inseparable companions are truth, justice, and kindness. Children smile and approach me when I rest in parks and gardens. I have never knowingly or willfully harmed anyone. I still love the things that I once loved, knowledge, poetry, nature, religion, liberty, the sun, the world's greenness, and I feel loved by those things in return. Let the dead leaves fall, Spring is immortal in her constant return. The only things that are gone forever are my teeth and my hair. You know, what a sweet old man. Now then, in our remaining portion of time, we need to look a bit at really the nature of his contribution. First of all, Levi rehabilitated and popularized the Kabbalah, especially within the occult revival of the mid and late 19th century. Kabbalistic studies were at a low point. The majority of Jews, with the exception of a very few secluded groups of eccentric reputation, such as the Hasidim in Poland and Russia, had repudiated the Kabbalah. Scholars, Jewish and other, advocated an unbalanced view of the Kabbalah. They looked upon the Zohar, the great Kabbalistic work, as a disreputable book, probably a forgery. Nothing could be farther from the truth. And had nothing good to say about the Lurianic Kabbalah either. Levi demonstrated that the Kabbalah could be utilized as the grand matrix of occult and spiritual experience. He pointed out that all the various preoccupations, studies, practices, visions, imaginations, and so forth of people who were interested in the esoteric field could be understood and sort of categorized or classified in terms of the Kabbalah. Another Kabbalist who certainly was a big student of Levi said later on that the Kabbalah is like a big filing system. Every experience that you have can find a place in it where you can file it. Of course, that was before computers. And so that Levi was really the first one to demonstrate that, you know, the entire esoteric field can be, let's say, utilized, made understandable and practical if it is combined with the great system of the Tree of Life of the Kabbalah. The things that otherwise would just sort of be out in left field, to use the vernacular, and would not be understandable, can therefore be then really utilized and understood. It was a way of understanding life and experience, especially unusual experience. So he reintroduced the recognition of the Kabbalah as something of great, what nowadays we would call psychological value, but let's say of spiritual and practical value at once. He also rekindled the interest of students of these matters in magic. Now, his definition of magic, it's a brief definition, is right here. He said, magic is the causing of changes in nature in accordance with will. This was modified by the magical writer and student of a somewhat later period, Dion Fortune, who of course was a trained psychologist as well, who said, magic is the causing of changes in the mind or psyche in accordance with will. Well, after all, that is part of nature also. But let's say it's probably important to keep in mind that Levi used the term magic, really, as an umbrella term for the esoteric, the occult, whatever you wish to call it. And in that, he was in that period, you know, students in the West tended to, in different historical periods, they tended to attribute the origin of esoteric wisdom to different places. Right after Napoleon went to Egypt, and then the French scholar Champollion deciphered the Rosetta Stone, and they had access now to Egyptian hieroglyphics, then all of a sudden, everything was coming up Egyptian, you know. Even fashion and styles in furniture and all kinds of things were all Egyptian-y. And Egypt was the source of all great wisdom. But Levi and his students felt, no, not Egypt, but Persia. Not Egypt, Persia. And that is why he used magic and the wisdom of the Magi. And he felt from Persia, which of course admittedly had a great deal of interaction with the Jews. After all, they were in Babylonian, as they call it, captivity, you know, more than once and all of that. And that from there it went, at least part of it, you know, also went as an inspiration to the Jews. And probably inspired the Kabbalah there, that Blavatsky held to that too. And that therefore, magic, the wisdom of the Magi, was an appropriate term for the esoteric wisdom. But along with that, of course, he had to address himself, and he did address himself very adroitly, very beautifully to the use of symbols. Because after all, he knew what we now bandy about so often, that the Kabbalah and, you know, any of these great bodies of teachings are in a sense symbol systems. And you can't, in other words, you can't really fully take advantage of these systems of wisdom if your approach is a verbal, conceptual one without any other. You won't learn it from the words. Although words are there, you know, you won't learn it as an intellectual concept, even though intellectual concepts are there. But you may enter into its spirit by way of symbols. Because the symbol, as I think certainly Jung indicated, and one of Jung's students stated, it'll come to me who, that the symbol is the cipher that unlocks the mystery. The symbol is like the key whereby you open the door to that which otherwise eludes your comprehension. Okay? The symbol, therefore, is tremendously important. And really the verbal and the conceptual that you may surround that symbol with is just kind of, well, I don't know, to use a culinary example, like the garnishing on a plate. You know, you can have some parsley there and a little bit of carrots. In the center is the symbol. The symbol is the steak. Now, if you guys don't like steak, then make it something else. You can baptize a turnip and, you know, see, now you are a steak. But, you know, whatever. It's the center, it's the symbol is the main dish. And therefore the symbol is tremendously important. And the symbol, because he already had the kind of psychological understanding where he said, because the symbol changes reality by changing you. Eh? Mm. Now this is worthy of a Carl Jung, you know. And he also repeatedly pointed out that it is for this reason that a poetic symbolic approach to these matters is the best. Now he enunciated this at the time when science was rising and arrogating everything to itself, and when, you know, even a little bit later on, of course, you know, even occultists so-called, you know, try to refer to occult science. Everything had to be science. Fortunately, that approach has somewhat dissipated now. But Levi was, of course, in terms of historical period when he lived and his literary associations and so forth, he was not only an occultist, but a romantic. He was a true child of the romantic era. In a sense, it may be said, of course, that so was everybody who is really interested in these matters. I would even venture to suggest, whether we are really all conscious of that or not, that the reason that we are here tonight, that the reason that we are interested in these matters is the following: because it is exciting. because it is beautiful, because it brings color, mystery, transformation into our lives. If we don't feel that, then we're not going to do too much with these subjects. Now we can have, of course, all kinds of highfalutin words. Oh, yeah, it's because I want to help humanity and all of that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. As Edward G. Robinson would say, yeah, yeah, yeah. The issue is because it's exciting, because it feels good. You know, I felt that way early in my early years, and I went after it like a dog who can smell something good. And you know what? I never was disappointed. And I doubted that in the time remaining for me will bring any kind of disappointment. And so what distinguishes Levy from the average later occultist is really that he does not apologize for his romanticism. He knows that what he is devoted to brings excitement and romance and passionate enthusiasm and the true poetic frenzy, you know, the furor poeticus, as the Romans called it, and that it's all over his writings. So that's very important, because it's also combined with something which is the key conceptual expression of this that he mentions over and over again, that imagination. L'imagination magique, the magical imagination, the creative imagination, is, you know, the that sort of the energy that makes you turn the key with the symbol. Here is something that he wrote that is, I think, appropriate. For the wise man, to imagine is to see. As for the magician, to speak is to create. The imagination of the adept is diaphanous, whilst that of the crowd is opaque. Diaphanous, you see through it. You see something beyond it, beyond that imagination. But the prosaic thinking is opaque. You don't see through it. You don't see something behind it. Then he says, the light of truth traverses the one as ordinary light passes through clear glass, and is refracted by the other, as when ordinary light impinges upon a vitreous block full of foreign matter. That is the ordinary, the prosaic approach. So to become an adept in the, as what he calls, magic, the adept, the person, must do something with his imagination. He must make it clear. And it is in this clarifying of the imagination, once again, that the symbols play that great role. And he was, in addition to all his other talents, the old gentleman, well, he wasn't always old, was a fine artist, a fine illustrator. And all his books are illustrated by his own hand in black ink drawings, very, very, very nicely done, you know. But, of course, he said, he also caught on to a symbol system that really hardly anybody paid any attention to in a significant way up to that point. I mean, Kabbalah at one time, you know, you got to remember, not then, but say up till including maybe sort of the 1500s into the 1600s, Kabbalah was tremendously important. Tremendously important. Tremendously important to the Jews, and then by way of the translations which were undertaken in the Renaissance period to much of Christendom as well. It was a very, very big thing, but then it waned. But while Kabbalah at least had a time of tremendous flourishing among really important people, this other symbol system of modality that Levy had discovered and came to combine with the Kabbalah, I mean, nobody paid really any attention to it except a bunch of gypsies, and that was the tarot, the tarot. Levy discovered in the tarot a symbol system which he felt was of immense value. And again, I mean, he said that the divination with the tarot was all right, but even the divination could occur only because the tarot is a tremendously symbolic system. And it, so he valued the tarot because of its capacity to do what? To stimulate the magical imagination. As indeed symbols are wont to do. He had that famous saying, which I don't have with me, but it's on the title page of my little book on Tarot and Kabbalah. Eliphas Levi said that if he were to be, or anyone were to be exiled to an island where nobody can come to you, nothing can be brought to you, the one thing that he would want to have with him is a deck of tarot cards. That by working with this, by contemplating this, by allowing these symbolic images to stimulate your imagination, you would have a very full life. So undoubtedly that tells you something. Now, in order to place, let's say, the tarot into a meaningful relationship with what he considered to be really the whole great cosmic system, for the first time, as far as we know, for the first time in all of history, it was Eliphas Levi, Alphonse Constant, who came to place the tarot cards on the Tree of Life. There is absolutely no evidence that anybody else has done that before. He said, the greatest universal alphabet of all symbols, which is the tarot, especially the 22 major arcana. Here is a little quotation from him where he says, the 22 keys which form the universal alphabet of the tarot, together with the truth of our affirmation that all secrets of the Kabbalah and magic, all mysteries of the elder world, all science of the patriarchs, all historical traditions of primeval times are enclosed in this hieroglyphic book of Thoth, Enoch, and Cadmus called the Tarot. And you know, he had a very flowery and very romantic, very energetic way of reading. If you look at just page one of his Transcendental Magic, goes on and on, it goes on like a literary steam engine with one metaphor after the other, one symbol after the other, you know, that this is the great wisdom that has been with us since the beginning of time and how important it is, and really, really exciting and highly romantic reading. So he connected the 22 arcana, or major arcana of the tarot, with the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet, and consequently with the 22 channels or paths on the Tree of Life. And he gave quite detailed explanations of the symbolism of all of these. The main fact to remember is that Levi differs from many later schools in terms of the attributions in one particular way, because of where he places the fool. His preference is for inserting the fool between arcanum or key 20 and 21, down by the bottom of the Tree of Life, although his system admits of placing the fool at the very end of the series as well. So otherwise it's between judgment and the universe. Also in his system, justice is still the 8th arcanum and strength the 11th, which were reversed by the people of the Golden Dawn. All this time I didn't mention his name, you know, for a variety of reasons, initially probably a matter of safety. An awful lot of these people, especially in the French tradition, always wrote under a pseudonym. But the pseudonyms were meaningful pseudonyms that they picked for some reason. So when he started studying Hebrew, and he went to a Hebrew scholar, rabbi, and studied the Hebrew and so forth, when he started studying Hebrew, he sort of translated his own name, Alphonse Louis Constant, into Eliphas, which was Alphonse, Levi, which was Louis, and Constant into Zahed, which means the constant one, you know, the persevering one, the strong one. So he then called himself Eliphaz Levi Zahed. His other two other books on magic, The History of Magic and The Key to the Mysteries, are, well, let's put it this way, are just like sequels to books that people write, are always inferior to what they started out with, to which they write the sequel. They are not as important and as powerfully filled with material as Transcendental Magic. Transcendental Magic is his chief work. It was translated by Arthur Edward Waite and is still available in that translation, with a pretty good introduction by Waite. Waite is a difficult writer because he rejoices in knocking everybody but himself, you know, and he does a little of that too, but he was very, very interested in, very reverential of Levi. Waite read about Levi in Madame Blavatsky's books first, and then he went and read Levi in the original French. Madame Blavatsky, by the way, quotes, I think it's in the, is it in the Secret Doctrine, 333 times does she quote Levi. That's when she gives credit to him. And she quotes him otherwise too. In fact, you know, people do all kinds of things. And somebody, my late friend and teacher, Alvin Boy Kuhn, did that for his doctor's dissertation at Columbia. He tabulated statistically the various, how many times did Blavatsky quote from various authors. And Eliphaz Levi was way out in front of anybody else, you know. And so all of these people regarded Levi very, very highly. Now, we need to finish very quickly and very soon. In Transcendental Magic, Levi also makes, I think, a very cogent statement about his relationship to the Christian tradition and, for that matter, to the Catholic Church. He never really, let's say, spoke in a derogatory fashion. He never really disavowed the Catholic Church, as many people who are antagonistic to the Catholic Church would have liked him to do. But on the other hand, he did feel that some serious difficulties had arisen throughout the ages, and he, to put it very quickly, because we need to finish now, is that he felt that Christianity was at first an initiatory mystery school based on secret teachings of the Hebrews, many of which originated in Persia, and also, you know, somewhat blended with the teachings of classical pagan antiquity, that Jesus was a hierophant, an initiator, a master of gnosis, and that later all of this vanished. Only some of the external symbolism remained, usually misunderstood as literal representations of objective truth. And let's say he had an appreciation and a reverence for what the church originally stood for, and for the vestiges, the remnants of that original initiatory wisdom which was still present in the church. And he said, this is valuable, this is important. And moreover, these people, you can forever extol their faults, but they are responsible for the spiritual welfare of millions and millions of people, and I wish dearly that they would do better at it, but at least they are doing something. And that was sort of Levi's. So Levi had, let's say, a guarded regard for the Catholic Church. You see, well, what about the Protestant Church? Well, first of all, there were none of them around where he lived, you know. So he wasn't exposed to that. Otherwise, to finish off, he was also perhaps the very first. After all, you got to remember, he died when Blavatsky was just starting her theosophy, really, her theosophy, the very same year. He was the very first one who was the great exponent of an idea of universalism and unity. To him, somewhat like to Emerson and others, the unitary principle was the one worth emphasizing most. Reality was unity, not diversity. You know, his criticism, such as he voiced of various dualistic schools, was grounded. He said, divine understanding unites, human misunderstanding divides. So he said, from a higher perspective, opposites are not contradictory, but complementary. And in this respect, of course, he was a true Kabbalist. And here is an interesting statement of his, which, because of the time that has passed, I will have to let you reflect on your own. The Church is wrong in denying the human in God. The atheists are wrong when they deny the divine in man. And then he says, isn't Jesus the God-man? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can see that you could very easily construct a kind of esoteric Christianity from his writings, which no doubt would have Kabbalah in it, but then after all there was a Christian Kabbalah too for many hundreds of years. Incidentally, I promised to mention that to you, this is just a little unfortunate fact. For many, many years, they reposed in the vault of the Philosophical Research Society under Mr. Manly Palmer Hall, a manuscript, an original manuscript by Eliphas Levi, which was entrusted to his disciple Baron Spedalieri, and was written in Levi's own handwriting with his own illustrations. Mr. Hall gave it to me to read once, and it was in very easy French. And I, even my inadequate French sufficed to understand, shall we say, most of it. And I really tried to prevail on Mr. Hall to publish it. But he said, well, maybe we'll save up a little money and then we'll publish it. And really should be published very nicely. It should be in a beautiful format and all of that. And then Mr. Hall died. And you know what happened? The last time I saw it, a portion of the manuscript was missing. And now, wherever the remaining part of it is worthless. So somewhere in the aftermath of Manly Hall's death, somebody pulled out a couple of these were little, like school, 19th century school children's workbooks, you know, lined, in which it was written. And out of, I don't know what, about 15 or 16 or 17 of these filled up workbooks, somebody had made off with two. So this sic transit gloria mundi, thus passeth the glory, very, very unfortunate. But let us say, one way or the other, Alphonse Louis Constant Lévy will always be with us. Because he started something that he dug a well from which there bubbled a stream of extremely valuable, inspiring and transformative and nourishing spiritual water that never stopped flowing. And it continued through the rest of the 19th century, throughout the entire 20th century, right up to now. Everybody who is the slightest bit knowledgeable in this field owes some of that, a good deal of that, to Eliphas Levi. Certainly not everything, but a good deal of it. And for this, I think, it behooves us to be grateful. And before our eyes, there appears the portly, not very tall, bearded old Frenchman with that beautiful, humorous smile on his face and with a love in his heart that was never equaled and with the wisdom of his mind that we are still profiting from. Thank you, monsieur. Thank you.
Copyright on the Monsieur Dupin. Catalog number 3014-02.
Ah, et voilà. Richard.
For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.